If you feel like you're failing to find balance in your increasingly busy life, could it be that you're starting in the wrong place? Well, so many of us look for balance by trying to control the world around us. Well, newsflash, that is a losing battle. Neuroscience teaches us that balance starts from the inside and comes from balancing our brain function. As heady as that sounds, success can be found in some simple exercises and practices that easily work into even the busiest of lives. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Kristen Race, neuropsychologist, author, speaker, head of mindfulness for Solvassa, and corporate consultant specializing in brain-based mindfulness techniques. Dr. Race has trained over 50,000 people in schools, medical institutions, and corporate America, and is the author of the acclaimed book called Mindful Parenting. You need to break all of this down for us, Dr. Race. Thank you so much for joining us.
So I have to start off by saying something really funny, sharing something really funny. So I'm talking with a girlfriend the other day, and I tell her about this interview I'm about to do with you. And she said, you know, years ago, you never heard much about spirituality. And now it's all about sound baths and energizing our crystals and meditation. And now I have to learn about practicing mindfulness. What is that? And, you know, even though some of these practices are ancient practices and have been around for years and years, I feel like they're becoming more and more mainstream. Do you feel the same way?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when I started this work, Brandy, about even 12 years ago, people looked at me like I was trying to, I don't know, lure them into some kind of cult when I talked about mindfulness. But that has definitely shifted over the last 10 years as we see it everywhere. It's in the military, it's in our schools, it's, you know, it's become so prevalent that I think people are opening their minds to the mindfulness practices.
You know, we sign off every episode here at the Beauty Construct with thanking everyone, thanking our listeners for being mindful, for being present, for listening. But for those who aren't too familiar with the term, let's take a deep dive into it and explain it to all of us.
I think of mindfulness two ways. First, I think of a mindfulness practice. And that would be something like a meditation practice or anything where you are intentionally bringing your awareness to a point of focus, noticing that you've become distracted and becoming that back to that point of focus. So those kind of practices could include something like a mindful breathing practice where you're just bringing awareness to your breath. It could be a mindful listening practice where you're really paying attention to the sounds you hear, a body scan, a mindful eating practice. And all of those practices essentially train our brains so that we can bring more mindfulness into our day-to-day living. So we can be more present in our surroundings, we can be more engaged with the people around us, and we can have more awareness of our thoughts, our thought patterns, our decision-making, all kinds of things. So there's sort of two layers to it, and they work together. I think the more we practice mindfulness formally, the more mindful we are able to be in our day-to-day lives.
And over the years, in all of your research, I'm certain that you have found that so many people just get lost in their daily routines, whether that be being a parent or maybe having a hefty schedule at work. We tend to just get completely lost and we don't seem to take enough time out of our days for ourselves. Is that kind of what you have learned over the years? Or I guess what I'm getting at is, where did this all start? The research and just this idea of practicing mindfulness, where did it start? And was it something that you felt that you were lacking in your own life?
Right. Well, like you said, it started thousands of years ago. But I think the reason why it has become so relevant right now is because of exactly what you just mentioned. We are so busy. Our lives are so hectic. We have so many pulls on our attention and distractions. all of these factors, especially right now, bring us out of the present moment. Using just the cell phone as an example, how often do we, if we have any spare moment, do we use that to check into our phone, to see what's coming next, to see what emails we have coming in, to all of these things that are going to pull us out of what is right in front of us?
It's terrifying, especially now that they track your time, your screen time, you know, on the iPhones. It's terrifying. I'm like, what? I spent 6 hours today? No, I didn't. That can't be right.
I know. And I remember when I first saw the stats on kids and screen time, I thought that can't be true. But now that we're tracking, you know, they're helping us track our own, you can see how that can easily happen. When we're constantly pulled, we need that present moment to rejuvenate, to let parts of our brain restore, to just have moments to just be and reflect. And when we don't have those moments, what tends to happen is we spend a lot of time activating the survival mechanisms in our brains. So we get consumed by worry, we're distracted, we're inattentive. And all of this can lead to a sort of a low level feeling of constant anxiety, which isn't good for us. It's not good for our immune systems. It's not good for efficiency and productivity. And it's definitely not good for our relationships. So I think the reason mindfulness is so prevalent is because it helps us to stimulate other parts of our brain that allow us to combat all of those negative effects of our hectic, chaotic, crazy lives.
So, I mean, what is your backstory? Mm-hmm. I know that you're a mother. You practiced psychology first, right?
Let's see, about 14 years ago now, I was working full time. I was director of counseling services in a school. My background, I was also at the same time, I was working full time in this job and I was writing my dissertation studying the neuroscience of stress, which you'll understand the irony in a moment, because at the time I had a toddler, I was pregnant with my second child, I was working a full time job, I was trying to finish my dissertation before the second child was born. We had decided to do a major remodel on our house. And I thought I could just, you know, put my head down and trudge right through. Well, shortly after my second child was born, and I did finish my dissertation and all of that, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease that was triggered by stress. So here I was learning everything there was to know about the impact of stress on our brains and bodies. Meanwhile, I was doing nothing to take care of my own brain and my own body and received this diagnosis. And that really prompted me to pause and look at my life and look at the science and look at the world that my kids were growing up in. And I just started to get really curious about, I'd been reading all about the neuroscience and these very new studies at the time about how practices like mindfulness and yoga could actually change the structures inside our brains. And so I started doing some experimenting.
Had you done anything like up to that point, like yoga or meditation or anything like that?
So I had been practicing yoga for years, but for me, it was all about the workout. And so all of that shifted dramatically. And I started to change the way I was taking care of myself. I started to really look at the world my kids were growing up in. And at that time, I was working a lot in schools. So looking at the environments for kids. And putting my first piece of work in this area was creating a formalized curriculum for bringing mindfulness into schools and helping kids build resilience to stress. And then that evolved into training teachers, helping teachers with their own stress because their stress was contagious to their students. That led to me writing a best-selling parenting book called Mindful Parenting, which again, what I was becoming aware of is we had a generation of very stressed out parents raising stressed out kids. So we had to look at this whole system. Then I started giving talks on this parenting book and I had corporations coming and talking to me saying, can you come to my firm? Can you come to my clinic? And so we started to expand into programs for corporate settings, for medical professionals. And now I'm very passionate about my work with Solvassa and helping women bring mindfulness into things they already do in their daily lives, and also supporting working moms in general with what I call a Moxie Tribe, which is an online coaching community for working moms.
Now, you're still a working mother.
Yeah.
You still have all this going on.
Absolutely.
Do you ever get stressed out?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You still do. But now you know how to manage it.
I know how to manage it. I don't always do it perfectly. It is still, you know, a work in progress. I still get overwhelmed. I still probably spread myself too thin at times. But I think what I have realized over the years is there are habits and routines and rituals that I can put into place. And when I pay attention to them, and I make small changes throughout my day, it profoundly impacts my day and it impacts everybody around me.
What was it that you learned, though? Because you were studying one thing, you came across a couple of things, you know, shared the story with us that you had a million and one things going on. So what was it that made you want to take a detour and kind of share this message and learn more about mindfulness, learn about the practice, go out and teach the practice? Like, what was it? What was that pivotal moment?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think my initial reaction to my diagnosis of this autoimmune disease was, you know what? I'm going to pick up my family. We're going to move to the mountains in Colorado and live in a little bubble and everything will be great. I'll just fix this. And I did a lot to try to fix the stress from the outside, meaning I got childcare, I set up date nights with my husband, I tried to get help with planning meals, I, you know, put all these things into place. We lived in this small little town. So I put these things in place from the outside. And what I realized was that it doesn't matter how many of those things you put in place on the outside, how many date nights you schedule, how many days you get to work from home, what town you live in, what school your kids go to. The balance piece has to come from the inside. And we can't balance our lives from the outside. But when we balance our brains, and we can balance our brains through these mindfulness practices, we feel more balanced in all areas of our life. So we still have the hectic schedule. We still, you know, I still work several jobs. I work really hard. I get up early in the morning. I have two teenagers that have a lot going on. I still have all of those stressors, but I've become really good at knowing what I need to do to keep my brain balanced so I can bring that sense of balance to my life and to everybody around me.
So just to kind of extend the last question, like, what was it that you learned? Like, you mentioned the science behind it all. So what were some of those things that you learned that really hit home for you? And you know, realize that this is something that can be very impactful and very, very powerful. And I need to go and spread the word and share it with others.
Yeah. And that's a great question. And I think for me, it was really breaking down the stress response in our brain. So I always come back to the science of it. And when you look at how our brains respond to stress, and this may be a life-threatening stressor, you're being attacked by a wild animal, or your brain may see a stressor as, gosh, there's a big traffic jam and I'm going to be late to work. Or I just got a text from my mother-in-law and it really irked me. So our brain interprets all kinds of anything that is unfamiliar, that feels threatening, that feels negative, our brain interprets as stress. When that happens, our brain triggers a stress response. So this is our fight, flight, or freeze response. It floods our nervous system with chemicals. It makes our heart pound faster. Our breathing becomes quick and shallow. It also makes us impulsive. It makes us reactive. It makes us feel anxious and inattentive. So the other piece of this is that we have another part of our brain, the newer part of our brain, our prefrontal cortex. And this part of our brain is responsible for some really important skills, skills like problem solving, decision making, forward thinking. It's where we think positively and engage effectively with the people around us. So speaking very simply, we have this alarm, what I call the alarm part of our brain, that fight, flight, or freeze part. And we have our prefrontal cortex, or what I call the smart part of our brain. And in our modern lives, we have this alarm part of our brain being triggered all the time due to little stressors. I'm late. My kids can't find their shoes. Somebody forgot their lunch. I have a sick child. I need to buy all these holiday presents. You know, I have an inbox with 100 new emails. All of these little things constantly stimulating that alarm part of our brain make the smart part of our brain just shuts down. And so we have all of these negative feelings. We have this anxiety. We're impulsive, all of those things. What mindfulness does is it strengthens our prefrontal cortex. In the same way that we would use bicep curls to strengthen our upper arms, mindfulness practice strengthens the neural pathways in this prefrontal cortex of our brain so that we're better able to make decisions, to solve problems, to engage with the people around us, to think positively. And when I recognize this, that I could train my brain in the same way that I train my body, it was like this light bulb went off. You know, just by understanding the stress response, understanding why I was feeling anxious, why I was impulsive, why I was overreacting to my kids, all of a sudden that stress response made sense to me. And I could notice when it was occurring. And then I could use my mindfulness practices to calm that response, to bring my system back into balance so that I could respond thoughtfully to these stressful situations rather than just reacting impulsively in a way that made things worse. So when that science became really clear to me, A, about the stress response, B, about how many things in our lives are triggering the stress response all the time for us, for our kids, then it became very clear about, okay, when I can explain this to people and I can give them tools to manage it, it gives us some control. We understand why we feel anxious. We understand why we are reactive. And we're able to use that awareness to put some other practices in place that allow us to respond in a more positive way.
So how do we manage it? How do we incorporate mindfulness into our daily lives?
Yes, great question. There are several ways to do it. So we can practice mindfulness both formally and informally. A formal mindfulness practice is taking time on a daily basis to bring our awareness to the present moment in systematic ways. So that would include things like your meditation practice, bringing awareness to your breathing. It might be a body scan that you do before bed. It might be spending 5 minutes of your lunch eating mindfully. All of those things would be considered formal mindfulness practices. And these formal practices are like conditioning for our brain. They are the reps that you do in the gym to strengthen our prefrontal cortex. And I should say, the more we practice formally, the more aware we become of when we get triggered and when we get stressed, because we still are going to get triggered and we still are going to get stressed. So that's kind of the conditioning piece. And then informally, there's a lot we can do when we recognize that we have been triggered and that we're not operating from that smart state. Things like a practice that I call PBR, which stands for pause, breathe, and respond with intention. So when I notice I'm triggered, when my son comes down the stairs at 7:30 in the morning and tells me he forgot this huge math assignment, despite the fact that I'd asked him 3 times the night before if he had any homework. So that could trigger me, right? But I can notice the trigger. I can take a breath or maybe two. And when we do that by taking a deep breath, one of the things that happens when we're triggered is our breathing becomes really shallow. So by taking one or two deep breaths, I bring my sympathetic and nervous systems back into balance. And my prefrontal cortex comes back online, and then I can respond to that situation thoughtfully. So I just am able to create a little space between the trigger and the response to pause, breathe, and respond with intention.
So So not to put you on the spot, but is there something you can kind of walk us all through right now that we can do together?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, absolutely. Let's do it.
This would be an informal practice. So what I want you to do is imagine something that triggers you or gets that alarm firing in your brain, and try to think about something that happens often. Getting out of the house in the morning on time, traffic, a certain meeting you have during the week, or maybe it's a certain person that triggers you. So see if you can imagine that situation and notice the sensations in your body as you think about that situation.
You feel a little like fire.
Yeah, exactly. You may feel heat. Maybe there's some tightness in your throat or your chest. You might feel sensations in your belly, your upper neck. So just notice those sensations. And then see if you can let's take 3 slow, deep breaths together. So go ahead and inhale. Exhale. Inhale. Exhale. Inhale.
I love that even our listeners who are driving right now can do this.
I know. Exhale. Just don't close your eyes if you're driving.
Yeah.
And then see if you can bring to mind a response that would lead to the most positive outcome for this situation. And that's the basic concept behind pause, breathe, and respond. You may not always take 3 slow, deep breaths, but even 1 breath is often enough to calm your nervous system to the point where you can respond differently. Rather than just reacting in a way that's going to escalate a situation, we respond from a place that comes from a more grounded, thoughtful place. And the other thing that happens is when we do this, if it's around a situation with another person, us taking the time to take that breath actually calms their nervous system as well.
Hmm.
So there's some pretty fascinating interactions there. And the pause, breathe, respond is a practice I use all day long. And sometimes I even use it proactively before I open my inbox in the morning. I'll just take a breath and respond, you know, and think about what's coming at me and how I can respond thoughtfully.
Well, like I just mentioned, the listeners who are driving right now, just further proving you can really do it anywhere. I mean, that just took a few seconds. And whether people practice breath work or not, incorporating it into our daily lives seems to be kind of a no-brainer, because just taking a few deep breaths, I mean, I feel a difference.
Absolutely.
I'm certain that most people would. You feel like a little bit of a load has been taken off of your shoulders.
Yeah. And the reason is when we're stressed, our inhalations tend to be deeper than our exhalations. So if you can, you know, breathe in to the count of 4 and breathe out to the count of 6, that signifies your nervous system to elicit a relaxation response. So just a couple of rounds of breathing like that, making your exhalation a little bit longer, is going to bring your system back into balance. And I think about, for those of you driving, if you're stuck in traffic right now, you know, that's often something we can get really reactive when we're late. But maybe if you can take a few of those deep breaths and then respond with intention, what can you do right now in this time that you have? So, you know, maybe that means you get to listen to more of this podcast or another inspiring podcast that you love. Maybe it means you get a little bit of extra time to call that friend you've been meaning to connect with, or to listen to some music that makes you feel grounded. But rather than just reacting and letting those negative emotions spiral, taking a few deep breaths and seeing if there's a positive alternative to your situation. And sometimes there is, and sometimes it just kind of sucks and there's not a positive way to spin it, but you'll be able to respond in a way that's better for your brain and your body than just letting the negative emotions build on top of themselves.
I love that you mentioned that, because obviously there are people who I'm sure are listening right now who are going through some really heavy stuff. So this certainly is not a cure-all, but it is a way to manage our emotions and manage our stress, right?
Right. And I like to think of it as I learned from Rick Hansen this notion of first starts and second darts. So the first darts are the stuff that happens to you, or you can insert another word that happens to you in life. You know, the rough things that are thrown. We can't control those first darts. Then there's the second darts. The second darts are the negative emotions that we add to the first dart. So as an example, the first dart may be that I didn't get the job that I applied for. And then the second darts are, I am stupid, I'm unprepared, I am never going to make any money, I'm not going to be able to put my kids through college. You know, you can see how that can spiral, right? So I can't control, I did the best I could to get that job, I didn't get it. But then we start to throw all the second darts, and those are the ones that tend to be really damaging. And so when you're in those situations of those big stressors that you can't really control, try to, if you control anything, try to just be aware of the second darts, because those we can control.
So what are some of the most immediate, like instant benefits that we should expect to see by adding some mindfulness practices to our daily lives?
The people I work with, when they start a formal practice, and I am a big believer that your formal practice does not have to be a long practice, a long meditation. I think that 3 to 5 minutes can make a huge difference in your day. So my practice looks like I come downstairs in the morning. First thing I think about is my coffee. I set my coffee to brew. I spend 3 to 5 minutes paying attention to my breathing, and then I enjoy my coffee. So not a huge commitment. And when I do that, I am more focused in my work. I'm more creative. I get way more done. I'm more patient with everybody around me. I feel happier. There's a huge payoff in terms of the amount of time. I don't spend a lot of time meditating, but if I don't meditate, I tend to be way more scattered and easily distracted. So things take a whole lot longer. So there's an efficiency piece that comes in. It's profound. And sometimes we notice those benefits immediately, you know, in the first 2 or 3 days of a meditation practice. Sometimes if you've been highly stressed for a while, it takes a little bit longer for those benefits to seep in. But in general, what I hear people talk about is just a sense of ease in their day that they feel. They're less reactive to stuff. They're able to focus better and they feel happier. So it's a huge payoff for a very small and incredibly inexpensive commitment.
And are you finding that more and more people are open to this? I mean, you said you've been practicing and teaching for 12 years now. So over the years, are more and more people opening up to practicing mindfulness?
Absolutely. And, you know, like I said, people used to look at me like I was going to spray patchouli oil all over them or do something like that. And for me, what I have found to be the most effective in terms of getting people interested in this work is the science. And when they hear about the science, I mean, when we look into, when we take functional MRI scans of people's brain who meditate, their brain looks different. Their prefrontal cortex looks different, is functioning more effectively than those who aren't meditating. Their amygdala actually shrinks as they meditate. So there are physiological changes happening with this practice. And those are just kind of the cognitive benefits. We also see huge benefits in terms of our immune systems and our ability to heal more quickly. When they look at people who have conditions like psoriasis and who would go into a light box for therapy, some people were taught to meditate while in the light box for therapy. Others were not. Those who were taught to meditate healed twice as quickly. So the benefits are really so clear in the science right now. And it's still young. It's a young field scientifically. But what we're seeing, and when I can communicate that science piece, then it's a really easy sell. And that's why I think we're seeing it all over the place, is because the science is becoming so much clearer.
And you have done a lot of work in the corporate world. You mentioned that earlier, and I want to talk about that because your recent work in the area of neuropsychology has really been focused on programs for what you describe as kick-ass women with big-ass jobs. And I know that you have worked with some big-time women over the years. I don't know if you are allowed to share their names. If you are, please share them. But just talk about that, just incorporating these practices into the corporate world.
Yes. So one of the things that evolved was kind of, you know, me going from the focus on the family and then into corporations. And when I would go into these corporations, the number one thing that women were struggling with was balance. And it wasn't just impacting them at home. It was impacting them at work, too. And so I started to really hone in on this piece about creating balance in our brains, to feel balanced in our lives, because we were doing all of these things as working women to balance our lives, right? You have the meals that are delivered to your door. You have the sitter, you have the nanny, you get them in the right school. You try to put all these things in place. But even with all those things in place, if your mind is thinking about 8,000 other things when you go on the date night, then the date night is kind of useless. So it's kind of, I got really interested in how I could help women create balance. And that came through integrating small things into what we already do, because we're all so damn busy that I couldn't expect these people to sit on a cushion for 20 minutes twice a day and meditate. It just wasn't realistic. So I really started to focus on short, simple, formal mindfulness practices, like a morning meditation, things they could do during their commutes, things they could do with their kids over meals, parts of their bedtime routine to reinforce this mindfulness, things they could integrate into their beauty routine. And I've had the pleasure of, you know, I've had conversations with Sheryl Sandberg, and I've worked extensively with Sarah Blakely at Spanx, and done a lot of work with the Spanx corporate community. And it really has kind of ignited this passion for me in supporting working moms, because it's harder now than it has ever been. And when I say, kick-ass moms with big-ass jobs. First of all, just being a mom is a big-ass job. I want to clarify that, whether you're working or not. And sometimes I think when you're staying at home, it's even a bigger-ass job than those of us who get little breaks here and there.
I'm laughing right now because that is my job at the moment. And listen, let me make a confession right now. I think you all will laugh at this. I was one of those people who thought, oh, stay-at-home mom, what a life. I mean, right. What do? You just hang out on the couch and watch your soap operas and eat your bonbons? Yeah. No, I totally did. And boy, oh boy, was I wrong. Because, I have chosen to stay at home with my little one who is 10 months old right now. And I never stop. I don't know what's going on in the world right now because I don't have time to watch TV. So these women who, like yourself, threw in, you know, a full-time hefty job into the mom world. Praise to you, because it is hard, hard work.
It is hard work. It's hard work for all of us. And I think one of the beauties for me with the Moxie Tribe is as these women come together, and it's, you know, it's designed to be an online coaching community where I do a lot of the teaching, but a huge piece of it is the connection with each other.
What is it? Tell us a little bit more what it is.
So a Moxie Tribe is, like you mentioned, the tagline, kick-ass moms, big-ass jobs. We don't discern what kind of job you have. We take any job as a big-ass job, but we come together once a month and we focus on a theme related to our wellness. So we've covered happiness, we've covered balance, we've covered grit. This month we're talking about planning and goal setting for 2020. We do a teaching. We have small group goal setting workshops that are kind of networking type workshops. We have a challenge each month, and there's different levels of that challenge based on how deep you want to go on this particular theme. And the thing that has been so profound is that when we come together is the recognition that everybody is struggling with this stuff, that this is, like you said, it is really hard and we need to give ourselves a break. And so I try to provide some solutions, some ways, some simple tips and tricks that we can integrate into our busy lives to make our lives a little bit better. But I think a lot of the growth comes from the connections that are formed within that platform. And that's what's been most fulfilling and beneficial for me are those, to see those connections form, and the benefits to me to see that I've grown and that we're all growing together. So it's really been special and inspiring and ignited my work in so many ways that I never thought possible. I'm really enjoying it.
What are those tips and tricks? I have my pen and paper ready because I need those.
Yes. Simple. Okay. Let's talk probably the most basic practice that has the most profound impact that everybody loves, a practice called three good things.
Okay.
At the end of your day, you recognize three good things in your day and you share them with someone. These aren't big things. These are, the snow fell off my car really easily this morning. That's one of mine from this morning. It was a light snow. I didn't have to scrape my windshield. That's one of my good things. Maybe I got a good parking place at the store. My dog was so excited to see me when I came home from yoga class. That's one of my good things. So little things. So you recognize these three good things and you either write them down, or what I love to do is you share them with someone. So you and I, Brandy, we decide we're going to do this practice together. And each evening I set an alarm on my smartphone at 8 p.m. and I label it three good things. When that alarm goes off, then I text you my three good things, and that will remind you to text me yours. When we do this practice, what the research says, when we do this for just 2 weeks, we see lower burnout in our job. We're less anxious. We are happier, we improve our quality of sleep, and we feel more balanced in our lives. That's amazing. In 2 weeks, it takes 2 minutes a night. And when they follow people for 6 months after that practice, it trends better than Prozac for easing depression and boosting happiness.
Wow.
So we did this in a Moxie tribe in September. This was our challenge, was we had small groups, and each night you just had to post in your small group your three good things. And each morning I would wake up and part of my morning ritual became reading what everybody had written. And I can't tell you how happy September was just because I was reading all these amazing things that people were sharing.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty cool practice, and you can do it as a family. You can do it with your girlfriend that you haven't talked to since college. You can do it with your husband. You can do it as part of work teams. And it's just so easy with such incredibly profound benefits.
Yeah, I love that. I want to go back to the parenting topic and talk about your book. I have it right here, Mindful Parenting. Mm-hmm. I have to share something with you that I found on the internet today. I have to read this to you all. I think you'll get a chuckle out of it. So it says, how to be a parent in 2019 versus in 1982, which happens to be the year that I was born. But okay, in 2019, make sure your children's academic, emotional, psychological, mental, spiritual, physical, nutritional, and social needs are met while being careful not to overstimulate, understimulate, improperly medicate, helicopter, or neglect them in a screen-free, processed foods-free, GMO-free, negative energy-free, plastic-free, body-positive, socially conscious, but also authoritative, nurturing, but fostering of independence, gentle, but not overly permissive, pesticide-free, two-story, multilingual home, preferably in a cul-de-sac with a backyard and 1.5 siblings, spaced at least 2 years apart for proper development. Also, do not forget the coconut oil. Versus 1982, your only responsibility is just feed them sometimes.
Oh my God.
I was cracking up reading that. It's hilarious, but there is some truth to it. And so that leads me to the question of what happened? What happened to us in the past 37 years that we need people like you? Because 37, 40, 50 years ago, do you think that people were taking time out of their days to meditate, to do breath work, to practice mindfulness? But this is something that we all seem to need today.
Right. I love that, first of all. I love that. And it is so true. And that's why we all feel like basket cases, right? Because of all of that pressure. So a couple of things. You're right. In 1982, nobody was taking the time to sit and meditate, partly because they didn't have to. When I grew up, you know, so I was 12 years old in 1982. And when my dad came home from work, he worked, you know, he left at 7 o'clock in the morning. He came home around 6 in the evening, but at 6 in the evening, his day was done. There was no checking email. There was no talking about work. There was no, you couldn't do any of those things. So there was this kind of forced restoration period for his brain. We don't have that anymore. We come home. Maybe we're lucky enough to have a family dinner, in many circumstances not, but then we often dive back into, let's get a few more emails done. Let's do a little work on that project. Let's check my Facebook feed. So it's constant, and we don't have the natural wind down that our brain needs to stay healthy, productive, to stay in that smart state and get out of survival mode. And you know what? It's sadly, it's the same for our kids. When we went to school, we came home from school and we could let all that go. But now with social media, our kids come home from school and they're trying to maintain their brand 24/7. They have to be in the conversations. They feel like they have to be posting. They have to stay connected. They have to keep up their streaks. All of that, again, that's constantly stimulating the survival mechanisms in our brain. So we need it. That's why the mindfulness is such a big deal right now. Because unfortunately, that stuff's not going away. Those stressors are not going away. Right. But what we can do is we can build resilience. And mindfulness helps us do that.
And what else are we going to learn in your book? Obviously, you talk about that. You talk about the other things you mentioned. But what else are we going to get from mindful parenting? It says, simple and powerful solutions for raising creative, engaged, happy kids in today's hectic world.
Yeah. So the book, it essentially, a big piece of it is looking at what I call generation stress and the things that are causing stress for parents and for kids, what that does to our brains, and then how we can build resilience. So it's things like how to explain the stress response in the brain to your five-year-old in a way they can understand. We look at stimulation. So, you know, all of the media, the electronics, all those things, how that impacts our brains and how we can manage it, not get rid of it, but manage it. We look at schedules. We have so many opportunities for our kids these days, which is wonderful. Again, very different than 1982. It's wonderful that they have all of these opportunities, but we don't have to sign them up for every single one. And there's a lot of pressure to sign them up for every single one. Sign them up early, and you bet they're going to want you to engage 5 times a week in that dance studio, or you won't be in the front row at the recital. And there's pressure there to do all these things. Mm-hmm. So we look at schedules. We look at the value of playtime and what that does, free play, and what that does for the brain. And then I look at sleep and the tremendous impact of sleep on the brain and on our kids' brains. Kids sleep significantly less than they did a generation ago, and that has a profound impact on the way their brains function. And then we shift into this mindfulness piece. So how we can practice mindfulness as parents, how we can practice mindfulness as families, and lots of fun ideas for integrating mindfulness into your day and your activities with your family. I kind of break, after each chapter, I break down the practices from early childhood up through if you have teens. And I also talk about this, what I call the lost art of hanging out and just the value of downtime for us and for our kids and how important that is for our brains. You know, it's just coming out. I'm excited to announce it is coming out as an Audible here in the next couple of months, because for a while I've been telling my publisher, my audience are busy moms. They need to listen to this. And so it is coming out on Audible, but it also can be read in a way that you can kind of pick it up and dive into the chapter that you need the most and get some solutions and put it down.
you know, I'm going to take a little detour here because I'm thinking about like my typical day, which mm-hmm. is so busy with the 10-month-old. Mm-hmm. I was sitting on the couch with my husband last night after the baby went to bed. She sleeps for like 5 minutes at a time, by the way. This is why my days are just a mess. But yeah, so I get a whole 5 minutes on the couch with my husband and he kind of grabs my feet and pulls them up onto him. And I thought, oh, don't touch my legs. I haven't shaved them. Damn it. And he kind of, you know, he's like, oh, I don't care. I don't care. But I'm thinking about that. Like, I don't have time to shave my legs. Like, when, you know, doing it every day. I don't have time for that. I think of my skincare routine. What is that? I don't have a routine. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if incorporating just a couple of minutes of mindfulness into my day at some point, will that kind of make me more productive in other areas, do you think?
Absolutely. And I think, again, it comes down to we waste a lot of time in worries, anxiety, and distraction. And when we meditate and when we practice mindfulness, we strengthen the part of our brain responsible for productivity, attention, and awareness. So we just are more clear on what's going on in our head and what is the most important thing to be focused on. So that's one thing that happens. And then what I tell moms, especially moms of little ones, are look for just little windows to incorporate mindfulness into what you're doing. So thinking about, you know, even women who are breastfeeding, I talk about, there's all these apps, you know, on your phone to monitor your breastfeeding and all that kind of thing. But can you use that as a time to just bring awareness to your breathing and sensations in your body, and as to take that meditative approach to that? When you're walking in the stroller, instead of, you know, being on your phone, or when you're in the park, can you use that as an opportunity to practice mindful listening, or just being truly kind of present and engaged with your little one? At the end of the day, you know, in bed, can you practice some mindful breathing with them, or what I call finger breathing, which kids like, which is kind of opening and expanding your fingers with your breath. So looking for those little windows, and gosh, if you have 5 minutes for a skincare routine, can you put on that cleansing mask, and can you just take a moment to breathe?
Yeah.
Take a moment to write down things you're grateful for, why that mask dries. And then, you know, gently warm it off. The shower is a great place to practice mindfulness. Pay attention to the scents of the soaps, the shampoos. Feel the temperature of the water on your skin. Mm-hmm. And finally, cut yourself a break. I remember those days where it was like a shower. What is that? Yeah. You know, I was lucky if I could leave the house with a shirt that didn't have spit up all over it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you're just in it. You are in it, and try to treasure it as you can, as hard as it is, just try to treasure those moments.
But you made a really good point earlier. We all have time for Facebook and Instagram and mm-hmm. Twitter to search the internet. We all have time for that. So what if we cut that down, use some of that time for ourselves?
Absolutely. Just look at your, how much time are you spending on it? Maybe you make a goal to cut that in half, or cut that by a third, or just put some parameters around it. You know, this is going to be my, you know, some time I'm going to spend when I finally get this child down for a nap. I'm going to set a timer. I'm going to allow myself 10 minutes to just be brain dead and browse around. But after that, I'm doing something that's good for me.
Yeah. I have heard that aspects of mindfulness are a component of wellness and longevity, like including skin health and overall wellness. Is it a stretch to believe that mindful practices could make our skincare, our beauty routines even more effective? I know that you just touched on incorporating the mindfulness practices into our days make us more productive in those areas. But for women who are listening that are like, gosh, you know, I wish that I looked a little less tired. I wish my skin was a little bit more clear. Hey, I wish overall my body just felt better. How can we kind of marry all of those together and just feel better and even look better?
We all want to look our best.
Yeah. And
it is not a stretch at all. So if you think about, you know, we keep talking about this stress response and how stress takes us out of the present moment. It gets us in the alarm part of our brain. Well, another part of that is that stress response from our body's reaction is to direct oxygen, to direct our blood, to direct all of its resources to your heart, lungs, and brain, because they are the most essential for survival. And your body's interpreting these little things as a threat to your survival. So that brings everything, all of the, you know, the blood, the oxygen, everything else away from your skin. That's not good for our skin. So when we can practice some breathing, take those deep breaths, get out of that stress response, that has an impact on our skin, number one. The other thing, when we're stressed and anxious and overwhelmed, that skincare routine falls to the bottom of our list. So if we can get that stress and that overwhelm under control, and we can create healthy habits and rituals, which include taking care of ourselves, taking care of our skin, taking care of our bodies and our brains, that is going to significantly improve our skin. And then finally, when we can integrate some mindfulness into a grooming or skincare routine, then that's, you know, you're getting a two for one. If I can put, you know, a lotion or a serum or something on my skin and just enjoy how it feels as I massage it in, just notice the sensations, that's a mindfulness practice. So there are a lot of ways that it absolutely impacts our skin, our beauty, the way we feel about ourselves. And there's ways to reverse it.
And staying on those topics, I mean, here at the Beauty Construct, we're all about finding beauty and wellness and resilience and empowerment. I do think you check all of those boxes, Missy, but I'm curious, like finding beauty in your line of work, what does that look like to you?
That's a really interesting question. And I think that for me, it comes down to being able to recognize my own beauty. So because I'm a brain geek, right? I'm always going to come back to the brain science. We have this negative bias in our brain, again, a survival mechanism, that we're much more sensitive to the negative and than the positive. So looking in the mirror, I'm going to say, oh my gosh, I have this pimple. I have bags under my eyes. I wish I didn't have those wrinkles, are the things going through my head. And very rarely is it, wow, you look fit, your eyes look nice, your hair looks good. Those are thoughts that don't often come to mind. So I'm really trying to make a conscious effort now to focus on those positives, and that it's beauty is really about how I feel about myself. Who cares what everybody else thinks? If I feel beautiful, does it matter what anybody else thinks? But so often we don't feel beautiful because we're caught in the negative. So just trying to look at that and to notice those thought patterns and to see how I can shift into a focus on the positive as well, I think is how I see kind of beauty resonating within my line of work.
Well, Dr. Race, thank you so much for sharing all of that fascinating information. I mean, it really is. It's incredible that doing something for just a couple of minutes a day can really change so many things about our brains, about our body, about our outlook on life.
Yeah. And thank you. I really enjoy the conversation. And there are so many things that we can do, little things that my hope is we just don't get too overwhelmed by the thought of transforming our lives, but just looking for the little changes we can make that can have some pretty profound benefits.
Well, Dr. Race, thank you so much for sharing all of that fascinating information and convincing me, hopefully our listeners as well, that we all need to take a little time out of our busy days to breathe. Hey, you guys, you can read more about those simple breathing exercises to calm our mind and body, as well as other helpful parenting tips in Dr. Race's book, Mindful Parenting. You can purchase it on Amazon or on the link that's posted on our site. Here at the Beauty Construct, we believe in gratitude, kindness, and positivity. We practice mindfulness, and we do our very best to find the beauty in every single situation. I'd like to thank our guest today, and thank all of you for listening. May you continue to practice mindfulness today, tomorrow, and always. Coming up on the next episode of The Beauty Construct.
We should all know that that's a highlight reel, but we all treat it like it's real life. We all compare a person's highlight reel to our day-to-day. Anytime you do that, it's not going to go down a good road.
The Beauty Construct is brought to you by Selvassa. Learn more at selvassalife.com.